This week, we're in this process of talking about the hope of your calling. And in particular, about jobs and about job frustration. You know, part of our calling as God's people, and the reason we still have all the pictures up from Missions Week is that we are called to make a difference in the world. And probably the most significant place in which we do that is actually in our place of employment. Now, certainly in our families as well, we're making a difference, but God places us in a place of employment where we have interaction with various people, and that opportunity to make a difference is huge. That's where it plays itself out. But I don't know about you, but sometimes it feels to me that in my heart of hearts, I deal more with job frustration than I do with job satisfaction. Now, that might be strange for a pastor to say, but maybe I'll share a couple of illustrations as we go along. But I've had some conversations just this week that have reminded me of the nature of the job frustration that so many deal with. For instance, I got an email from an old colleague. He is a missionary over in the Netherlands. He took classes, doctoral classes, with me up in Lithuania. And he had written me a few months ago to let me know that he had completed, finally, his doctoral program that we started together down in Kandahar, Germany, just in 2002, years ago. And he finally completed it, and he was so excited, and it kind of made me a little feel bad inside. But anyway, he just wrote me because I haven't completed mine. He just wrote me this week, and because I was asking him, well, are you still with Wycliffe? Are you still doing that? And he said, well, unfortunately, we had some issues in Wycliffe where some outside voices were speaking into the project that I was involved with, in particular, in translating scriptures for Muslim contexts. And because of the way things went down, I really felt, because I was the lead on the project and there was so much resistance, and I just felt decisions were made against the best practices that we were trying to pursue, and so I felt like in good conscience, I needed to step down. So he says, so I resigned from Wycliffe and landed a job with an engineering firm in Washington, D.C., via contact I still had from the 90s when I was back in aerospace, because he also has a doctorate in aerospace. He's a brilliant guy. Well, it was a great job for 7 months. At that point, a planned corporate restructure fell apart and my position became redundant. I've been looking for a job now for almost 5 months without any results. I'm looking at engineering firms, nonprofits, universities. So far, nothing. It's a bummer. My wife and I are in the midst of boxes, packing up, putting things in a local storage, and moving in with her mother in Austin, Texas, next week. This clearly is a real highlight in a man's career. Smiley face. Brilliant, brilliant guy. Like I say, doctorate in aerospace engineering, doctorate in missiology. He's moving in with his mother-in-law. Some of you can relate. I would love to move in with my mother-in-law, just so to make the record clear. Yeah, no, sorry, just a little joke there. I was talking with another young man this week. He's been working in a coffee shop for a few years and hoping to kind of move up in that context. He's showed real loyalty, and he actually loves it. He loves working there. Now, he had recently got a merit pay raise, and at the same time, there was the legislation that came through in the city of Seattle to raise the salary levels kind of in a graduated scale up to $15 an hour. And so the first one was going to take things up to $11 an hour. He had been led to believe by his employers that his merit pay raise would be added on to the new standard of $11 an hour, and so was hoping for something. But as it turned out, he found out this week, his bosses had decided that they didn't say it this way, but that his efforts and involvement in the company was not worth giving him any more than just, well, the merit pay, which brings him up to $11.20, which is 20 cents over what anybody now is going to get just to start out with. And the frustration, it's like they don't even care. They don't even care about my commitment. They don't even care about my loyalty. Another conversation I was having with one of the brothers about just how the things our kids are dealing with, the difficulties and the completely different situation that they have now growing up than Karen and I had in our starting out phase. There is a shrinking middle class in the USA. In fact, from the late 60s, it's dropped from over 50% of the population being middle class households, making in today's dollars between $35,000 and $100,000 a year. It dropped from over 50% to just less than 42%. That's a very significant drop. The middle class is shrinking. And in fact, the top 5% of earners, the top 5% accounted in 2012 for 40% of the expenditures. Just to put it in a little bit more perspective, since 2009, when the recession officially ended, inflation adjusted spending by the upper 5% has risen 17%. The rest, the other 95, it's risen by 1%. So basically this jobless recovery that we're talking about, I mean, it really is that there's a struggle. Our kids are, you know, the very kind of basic things that we did, that Karen and I did when we started out, so getting a house in the first year that we were married, those are increasingly not possible for the children, you know, the college grads of our era, unless they're really in the high-tech bubble. And so that there is that high-tech bubble, and there's a lot of, you know, high-wage earners around, but the middle class is actually shrinking, and for those to get into a house is increasingly difficult. My folks, you know, they bought a house, and I did a little research. They bought it for $13,500 back in 1959. Now, inflation would have raised that to $42,500 in 1981 when Karen and I bought our house. But our house was a little bigger and a little more land, and so we bought our house for $75,000. So pretty much in the same kind of category. But by 2007, my folks' house sold for, inflation would have raised the value to $97,000, but what do you think it sold for in 2007? Almost $400,000. A little three-bedroom Rambler over in Redmond. $390,000. Four times what normal inflation would have. But the problem is that normal middle class wages have only risen at the level of inflation. So in order for, you know, to do the same thing my folks did, get into a house, you have to have two incomes, working pretty hard, going at it and sacrificing a lot more just to get this kind of staple of what was normal economic stability. I think we who are older really have to realize and recognize our children, my children's age, they do not have the same economic setting that we had growing up. It's a lot tougher. And so those are just three conversations that I had this week about this whole issue of jobs and job frustration and we get hit at various levels, kind of, and it's almost like body blows in some ways. And some are really struggling in their heart of hearts. Now, what do the scriptures have to say about it? Well, the scriptures, to a large extent, have to say it shouldn't surprise us. The scriptures say this should not surprise us that there is frustration. Let's talk about, you've got your sermon notes there, and let's talk about three basic ideas about work that we learn from the scriptures. The first is that work becomes fruitless. Work becomes fruitless. If there's any lesson from Genesis chapter 3, it's this, that because of sin, things fall apart. One of the most noticeable things that sin brings is shame, that sense of unease that with yourself at the heart of your being, that something is not really right. Something's wrong with us. We can't clearly identify it, and something's wrong with our situation. Adam and Eve then began to direct the blame at others immediately. You know, well, the woman you gave me, she gave me the apple to eat, or the fruit to eat. And, well, the serpent, you know, he tempted me and I ate. And so there's this blame game that goes on. Sin, what happens is it warps every part of our nature. Here's a quote. The Bible teaches plainly that Adam and Eve's fall into sin was not just an isolated act of disobedience, but an event of catastrophic significance for the creation as a whole. The effects of sin touch all of creation. No created thing is in principle untouched by the corrosive effects of the fall. Whether we look at societal structures such as family and state, or cultural pursuits such as art or technology, or bodily functions such as sex or eating, or anything at all within the wide scope of creation, we discover that the good handiwork of God has been drawn into the sphere of mutiny against God. The whole creation, Paul writes, has been groaning, is subject to bondage and decay. So sin comes into our situation and it warps God's beautiful plan for mankind. And in fact, it really impacts our work. So what does it say in Genesis chapter 3, verses 17? Well, Adam, by the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. By the sweat of the brow. Actually, this is a gracious reminder from God that from here on out, we're not going to be able to, we never could actually, but especially, we will not be able to do things on our own. We can't make it work on our own. Part of the curse is that work is frequently unfruitful. I had a situation. I wasn't going to share this because it's kind of embarrassing, but I had been working on this project where there was a leak in the wall, and so I'd torn out the sheetrock and put in some new piping, and I can do that sometimes. I was doing it with PVC pipe, and so then I put it back together, and I'd marked on the wall very clearly a couple of lines where the pipes were to make sure that, you know, when I put the sink back into the wall that I wasn't going to drill into it. Well, you know, I didn't get to it for like 2.5 months, so this, it just sat there 2.5 months, and I'd, you know, put the sheetrock on there and everything and sanded it down, got it all ready to go. And so now I'm going to, like, drill the holes for the sink to go into the wall. And so I had these lines there, and I remembered now in my mind 2.5 months later, oh, those are the lines where I have to drill the holes. Well, that's not what it was. Those were the lines where I was to avoid drilling the holes. So I'm going in there with my drill, kind of hit something. It's like, oh shoot, I must have hit a plate, a protector plate, you know. So I move a little bit, and then I hear this. Psst. And so all this work that I had done, you know, now it's like I'm tearing it apart. Sure enough, I've gone into the copper pipe. It's got a little tiny leak in it. Then it's like, oh, great. You know, now I've got to call the plumber because anyway. $300 stupid tax later, I'm redoing the whole thing again. Work is sometimes fruitless. Now, I don't know if you can blame that on the curse or if you can just blame it on my stupidity. I think that, but it's kind of a combination of both. You see, in work, there's so many moving parts. There's so many things that can go wrong, and it's kind of that whole issue of if things can go wrong, oftentimes they will. By the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat your food. It's going to raise up thorns and thistles for you. I was talking to Judine Albs this week, and I asked her, well, you know, when you were working in the medical environment that you were working in, what caused you the greatest frustration? She says, oh, no question, absolutely. It was when I would assign people a task to do, whether it was something really simple, like retrieve a piece of information or send a letter or make a phone call. And the person would then take my little note and stick it on their desk and say, okay, I'll get to it. And pretty soon it's piled up, and then, you know, it doesn't get gotten to. Thorns and thistles. We always envision more than we can accomplish. We aspire to change the world, to make a difference, but we discover that our own selves are constantly in the way. You might be an accomplished singer, but you discover that you're unable to make a living at it because you're skillful at music, but you're not skillful at self-promotion. All of us, I think, today can relate to the Google executive who says, my mission in life is to do something amazing for the world. Oh, we've got a whole generation of people who want to do something amazing for the world. But not everyone does, and part of the big reason we don't is we stumble over our own thorns and